Welcome to the last World Boards in Review for 2022. We're very honored today to have the Tuskegee Airmen represented. We have Colonel George Hardy here, and we have Colonel Harvey here. And this is Doug Rosenthal. And well, Doug here, he's the head trainer for all of the CAF Red Tails, and this is only one of two. You've got a P-51. What else you have?
We have several airplanes, about 170 airplanes in the CAF. The Red Tail Squadron, we have a P-51C Mustang that you've seen on this stage many times, but sadly it's in maintenance right now, so we couldn't be here. So we borrowed some airplanes from another group, and we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll take care of that later. First of all, Colonel Hardy, now your decorations, you had the DFC with Valor. You had the Air Force Medal with 11 oak leaf clusters and a Commendation Medal with an oak leaf cluster. And you were in the class of 44H. What kind of training do you look back on it? You feel like your training was pretty adequate?
We had very good training. I thought instructors were very good. And, I hadn't even driven a car when I went into flying training, and I came out as a pilot, see? And so they were very good, I thought.
Now, when you initially qualified, you went to what, the P-47, or P-40, and then the P-47, is that correct?
Well, I graduated from training in September 44, and then we got some time in the P-40, then combat training in a P-47 for 3 months, and then overseas in 1945.
And that was a P-51, so you went to the P-51s.
Overseas, we got a couple flights in the 51, then we're on missions. And but it was easier to transfer from one airplane to the other.
Now, you flew 21 missions, is that correct?
21 missions before the war ended.
All right.
The Germans gave up after the
But walk us through just a typical mission.
Well, a typical mission for us, we were flying out of Ramitelli, Italy. And Italy, there's a eastern coast, you see that little spur out. We were just below that. And 15th Air Force, and 15th Air Force had a number of bomb groups, B-17s and B-24s. They would take off, and we would meet them before they got to Germany and escort them on their missions over Germany to ensure that the German fighters didn't get to them or attack them, and escort them to the target and bring them back until it was safe. Then if the mission wasn't too long, and 51 had a lot of fuel in it, we'd go back and strafe targets of opportunity, anything to harass the Germans.
Okay. So that after the war, did you stay into the military?
I got out in 46 and went to NYU for a year, but I got married and went back in 48. And then I had a full career in the service when I went back in 48. I retired from active duty in 1971 as a lieutenant colonel.
So in Korea, what did you do in Korea?
Well, in 1948, when I went back in, I decided, even if I couldn't fly, I wanted to be around airplanes, so I went into electronics maintenance. The Air Defense Command had some fighters with radar on them, and I wanted to work in those. But instead of that, when I graduated from electronics training in August of 1949, I was assigned to the 19th Bomb Group on Guam, a B-29 outfit. It was the only B-29 outfit not in SAC. They belonged to MacArthur, his head in Japan. They were with him when the war started in the Philippines and went down to Australia and came back with him, and he kept them there. I was assigned in that group as a maintenance officer. But as a pilot, I also checked out in the B-29.
Well, you flew 45 missions, is that correct?
Well, I got put on a combat crew, yes, and ended up flying 45 combat missions on B-25s. And B-29.
Mm-hmm. Well,
my longest mission was 11 hours. So some of the missions took time there in the B-29.
So go through a typical mission and preparation for it.
Well, Well, let me take the first mission. The war started 25th of June, 1950. We were on Guam. We had to move to Okinawa. And I was a maintenance officer also, so I had to work doing that. And on the 30th of June, our crew flew our first mission. And the first mission was to bomb the North Koreans were coming down through the mountains headed to Seoul, whatnot. We were supposed to bomb the paths up there. But things were not clear to us then. And the place was cloudy. And so just before Truman said we could go into North Korea, we started heading and finally ended up over Wonsan, not sure what to do, except we got called back that the target had cleared, so we went back and bombed the original target. But we almost dropped some bombs on ships in Wonsan Harbor. When war started, things were not that clear as to what to do. We're just looking someplace to drop a bomb.
Well, how many missions did you have interference from the MiGs?
In what?
MiGs.
Oh, I didn't get involved in MiGs. But I will say one thing, that we had racial problems. I was the first Afro-American in the 19 bomb group. And I was put on a crew, a makeup crew, because we had enough gunners and whatnot. And I was the maintenance officer. The pilot was the personnel officer. The adjutant of the squadron was the bombardier. We had extra jobs, and we made up a full crew. And we started flying over Korea. But I knew, got a new squadron commander who wouldn't speak to me in May. And when we got up there on the 12th of July on the 7th mission, I finished checking in the cockpit before takeoff, and suddenly I heard Hardy get down on the airplane. He replaced me on that mission. It was a mission up over near Wonsan. Anyway, later in the day, that was the first B-29 shot down over Korea with my crew and without me. Mm. And but fortunately, he was transferred several weeks later to group, and a new commander put me back on a crew, and I got to fly 45 combat missions.
So you flew your 45 combat missions, you came back, and you were now a maintenance officer, maintenance in the B-36s.
Well, when I came back from overseas in 51, I came back as a flight crew member because I'd flown enough missions. But SAC, I went into SAC, and they saw I was an electronics maintenance officer. They put me in. They had separate maintenance squadrons, Armored Electronics Maintenance Squadron. I did electronics. They immediately sent me to Denver for 7 months for the armament. I was a fully qualified Armored Electronics Maintenance Squadron. And I had a career in maintenance. I ended up as a maintenance squadron commander in 62. That was my main job. But I would still fly as base flight airplanes, whatnot. But I spent a lot of career in maintenance. I loved maintenance. But B-36 was worked on that too. It was quite an airplane. And then I went into technology and then to Japan. And then to Plattsburgh, New York as a squadron commander and maintenance squadron.
Well, on the B-36 is a lot of moving parts there.
A lot of moving parts on B-36. That was the biggest airplane we ever had. Had six reciprocating engines. The props were on the rear of the wing. And it had four jets, 10 engines to take off. And those things were based in Fort Worth and places like that. And theoretically, they could fly from Fort Worth to the Soviet Union, drop their bombs, and come back without refueling. They were huge. Someone your size could walk right into the wing from that's how big the wing was, from the fuselage. So it was quite an airplane to maintain and to fly. So.
Well, now, did you go from there directly to the air refueling squadron, the squadron commander?
I went for 2 years in 55, 57 to Institute of Technology and got a degree in engineering. Then I went to Japan for 3 years, then to Plattsburgh, New York, and became a squadron commander up there in refueling wing. And that's when my life changed up there. That same officer who pulled me off that airplane in Okinawa was now my wing commander. And I worked for him for 2.5 years. And it was probably the best 2.5 years of my career under him the second time.
He had changed?
He had changed, yes. The only time we talked about career was one day in a club. I was sitting there having a brew with people, and he slapped me on the back and said, "George and I fought the Korean War together." Yeah, okay, we did. But I got along so well with him the second time because I didn't hold a grudge, but I wanted to see how he was. And I got to like him.
Yeah.
And we like to work for him for 2.5 years.
Well, let's jump a little bit ahead of here and go to Vietnam now, the Vietnam conflict, and you're in a really unique.
Well, Vietnam came much later.
Right.
Now, in 62, I went to Institute of Technology, contacted me to go to graduate school. I went back and got a master's degree in systems engineering in 63 to August 64, and then I went to systems command for 5.5 years. And I worked in systems command, installing systems overseas. And I ended up the chief of engineering and program manager for the overseas Audubon switches program. I worked for that for 3.5 years, but just the time we cut over the first switches in Europe, they were looking for pilots to fly in a 119. They made a gunship out of the 119, the AC-119,
right,
flying boxcar. It was obsolete then, but they modified 52, and 26 of them were K models, which they had heavy guns on them, 20-millimeter Gatling guns. It was overweight, so you had two props and two jets on the airplane, and that's what I flew as a gunship. We looked for trucks going down to from North Vietnam, down through Laos and whatnot, look for trucks at night, and pick up targets with infrared equipment, and fly around them, flying circle, and we knocked out a lot of trucks. The 20 millimeter gun was pretty powerful, 6 rotating barrels, and would only fly at night because we were low and slow, and that was our protection.
So you as a pilot, you did the aiming, is that correct?
The pilot controlled the plane going around, and the co-pilot controlled the altitude. But you had a gun sight here on the pilot. You got the flying angle, you got around, you got everything set up, and you had a crosshair in there. And the infrared operator would pick up a target, and the crosshair would end up in the gun sight. And the pilot would have to fly and get the angle right, and the crosshair is superposed on the other. The pilot flying the airplane shoots the guns because the guns are fixed.
Right.
So, and you shoot it for 1 or 2 second bursts, and that's 100, 200 rounds. See?
So you flew 70 missions.
70 missions doing that. Ooh. Well, the thing is, I was a lieutenant colonel, and when I got over there, they really took my crew away from me when I got to Phan Rang, which is a base, but the airplanes are Udon, Thailand, or Da Nang. After briefing over there, I became the commander at Udon and then moved to Da Nang. So I didn't fly as many missions as the other pilots, but I flew 70.
So you retired in 1971. What did you do between Vietnam and 1971?
Well, I came back from overseas in 71, and I had a physical, and they took me off flight status for something I had before I went to Vietnam. So then I put in for retirement. So.
You were physical enough to fly in Vietnam, but not physical enough to get back in the States.
That's right. So I put in for retirement and retired in November 1971.
Out of all of these airplanes that you've flown, what was your favorite airplane?
Well, the B-51, naturally. I was 19 years old flying this plane by myself. And it was a 51 was a marvelous airplane. You couldn't beat that. So,
how old were you when the war was over?
Well, when I was flying in 51 in Europe, I was still 19. But 71, I'm trying to figure how old was I. I don't remember now.
That's no problem. That's no. Colonel Harvey, I'd like to talk about what class were you in? When you went through?
You say class?
Yes. What class?
Pilot 44I.
And so when did you graduate? When did you graduate
when?
From pilot training, yes.
College?
No, from pilot training.
Well, October 16th, 1944.
Okay. How difficult was it for you to get into the pilot training program to start off with?
Well, January 1943, I tried to enlist in the Army Air Corps, and they said they weren't taking enlistments at that time. That was the height of the war. So the only thing left was my color. They didn't want me. So I was drafted into the Army in March of 43.
And then how did you get into the pilot training program?
Okay. I went to Fort Meade, Maryland. I took my physical, took a written exam, got my shots. And then I was signed to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri for 30 days of basic training. I went to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, got my training. And when I finished, they put me in the Army Air Corps Engineers, driving bulldozers, graders, carryalls. My mission was to go into the jungles of the Pacific, doze out an area, and build an airfield. And we used to go out and practice every day in a little town called Accotink, Virginia. All this dust and perspiration. I said, no, this isn't for me. So I applied for cadet training. And there were 10 of us, 9 whites and myself, that went to Bowling Field. We took the exam. After the exam was over, only 2 of us passed. And from there, I went to Keyser Field in Biloxi, Mississippi, for 30 more days of basic training. I completed that, and the rest is history.
Now, when you got through training, you went over to the 332nd Fighter Group. And what airplane were you flying there?
Well, while I was in combat training, I flew the P-40, the P-47, the Razorback, and then the P-47D.
Okay. So how many missions did you fly over there?
I did not make it to Europe.
Oh, you did?
Okay. I finished my combat training in April of 45. Had my bags packed, within 1 hour catching the train to go to Norfolk to get on a ship to go over and join the group. We got a message saying to hold us. The war in Italy was over, and they expected to wind up the whole European theater. Well, Hitler gave up the following month of May, so I would have been on the high seas.
Well, tell us about 1949 and the USAF aerial gunnery competition, about how you trained for it and what General Davis said to you before you left.
Okay. In January of 49, the chief of staff of the newly formed United States Air Force sent a directive out to all the fighter groups in the United States that they were to have weapons competition between each group on each base and each pilot in each squadron. And then they were to pick their three high scorers to represent their fighter group in the first ever Top Gun weapons meet to be held in May of 1949. Well, us, the 332nd Fighter Group, we had scores because we had just been to Eglin 7 a month prior. So based on our scores, Captain Temple of the 301st, Harry Stewart of the 100th, myself of the 99th, were chosen as primary members, and First Lieutenant Halbert Alexander of the 99th as an alternate member. So that was our team representing the 332nd Fighter Group.
So you were the... What kind of training did you do before this? Anything particular?
What was
the P-47? Now, you were... The P-47 was of the other airplanes that were in this competition. You were the one that was the least qualified as far as aircraft. Is that correct?
Yes, we were flying the obsolete P-47. It was a good aircraft, but it was still obsolete. And our competitors were flying P-51s and P-82s. Now, the P-82 looks like 2 P-51 fuselages, 1 wing, and 1 horizontal stabilizer. That's your P-82.
So they didn't figure you were much competition, I suppose.
We didn't have any competition.
No, you did. But they didn't figure you were going to be competition.
Oh, no. No one did. No.
Now, after you won this thing, what happened after you won the award?
Okay. We won the competition. However, we were never recognized as the winner. The Air Force Association puts out a magazine every month. Once a year, they put out an almanac. One of the items in the almanac are the winners of the 1949 weapons meet through present day. Well, today it's called Red Flag. It's altogether different. It's all electronics. But each year when that almanac came out, the winner of the 49 weapons meet was listed as unknown. Finally, in April of 1995, our group commander called me and asked me if I had any data on the meet. I told him no, maybe Stuart did. So he called Stuart. Stuart said he didn't have it. He could probably find it at Nellis. So he went to Nellis. He found what he was looking for. And as of September of 1995, it shows the 332nd Fighter Group as the winner of the 1949 weapons meet. 46 years.
And this trophy was hidden all this time.
The trophy somehow got misplaced, the big 3-foot solid silver trophy. Somehow it got lost. We have a lady in Atlanta, she's an historian. She made it her mission to find it. She found it in 5 days at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base Museum storage area. So she went to Wright-Patt and she saw the trophy and she asked, why isn't this on display? They said, we get a lot of items in. We can't display everything. This item will never be on display. Well, it is on display, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base Museum.
Talk to us a little bit about your tour in Korea. Now, you flew in Korea also, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
How many missions did you fly in Korea?
In Korea, I flew 126 missions. In 89 what, days.
In what airplane?
The F-80.
The F-80.
F-80.
The P-80.
Now, when I was at Lock, they broke our group up in May of 1949 and scattered us all over the world. I mean June, sorry, June of 49. That's right after the weapons meet. And actually, integration started in 48, but nothing happened until they broke our group up. Well, Eddie Drummond and I, we were both in the 99th. We were scheduled to go to Misawa, Japan. It's up in the northern part of Honshu. Before we transferred out of from Lockbourne, our 201 file was sent to the wing commander at Misawa. Wing commander, and our picture was in that file. So the wing commander called all the pilots, base pilots, into the base theater. Said, we have these two Negro pilots coming in, and they'll be assigned to one of the squadrons. Well, the pilots told us this themselves. They said, no way are we going to fly with them. No way. Okay. Eddie Drummond and I reported into the wing commander. We're sitting there chit-chatting. And he says, what do you want us to call you? I said, well, I'm a first lieutenant. Eddie Drummond's a second lieutenant. How about Lieutenants Harvey and Drummond? He said, okay, what you were supposed to do anyway. Let's see. All of a sudden, my mind is wiped clean. they did not have a team. Then he said, we have 3 fighter squadrons on the base, 2 P-51 squadrons and an F-80 squadron. Which one do you want to go to? The F-80 is a jet. Which one do you want to go to? I said, F-80. So he put us both in the F-80 squadron. Now, they did not have a T-33, which is the trainer version right. of the F-80, but they did have an AT-6. We flew that in advance. In the back seat of the AT-6 is a hood. You can pull up, lock it. You can't see out. All you can see are your instruments. Now, each one of us had 2 rides in the back seat of this AT-6. So we'll use myself as an example. I get in the airplane, pull the hood up. All I can see are my instruments. The pilot up front, which is one of them, they get taxi and takeoff instructions from the tower. Taxi out. He lines up on the runway and says, okay, you've got it. So I apply power down the runway, get off the ground, pull up the gear, mixture control, prop pitch, all that stuff you do in a conventional aircraft. Fly around during the maneuvers he wants me to do, and then contact ground control approach. They vector me in for a landing, and then when I touch down on the runway, the pilot up front took over. What does that have to do with flying the F-80? Nothing. This bothered me for years, and I finally figured it out. They wanted to see if we could fly, and we proved we could. We were always proving that we could fly, no matter where we went. Anyway, We proved that we could fly. Then the Korean War started in September 25th
June 25th, 1950.
That's when the war started in Korea. Anyway, at this point, I'm a flight commander scheduling these guys to fly. And we're not having any problems whatsoever because they know that I can fly. I'm a Tuskegee Airman. So right there, that says a lot. So I'm scheduling them to fly. The Korean War starts. We're in Osaka, Japan at gunnery training. So we immediately are deployed to Itazuki, the next island down, and started flying missions out of there. And our first missions were circling Seoul while they evacuated civilians out of Seoul. We're still in Itazuki. I was on a bombing mission leading a flight of four F-80s, leading three F-80s because I was in the fourth one. And we've been on a bombing mission. We dropped our bombs up in northern Korea. And on our way, we still have a full complement of 50 caliber ammunition in our guns. And we're in the Pusan area of South Korea. And we get a call saying they have some ground troops pinned down in the mountains and they needed help. Would I be able to help? I said yes. So I led the other three guys. We dropped down into the mountain area. We found it was cloudy this day, so all the valleys were covered with clouds. We found the targets, we emptied our guns in the target area, pulled back up on top, and flew back to Itazuki, Japan. A couple weeks later, we got a telegram from the commander of the troops that were pinned down, and he thanked us for what we had done, because we had killed about 1,200 of the enemy.
Wow.
Now, in a jet aircraft, the speed of the aircraft plus the muzzle velocity of the bullet, one bullet can do a lot of damage. But anyway, mission accomplished. And on that mission, we all got the DFC.
Now, all these airplanes that you've flown in your career, what's your favorite airplane? What's your favorite airplane of all the airplanes you've flown?
The F-102, big Delta Dagger.
How much time did you get in that?
Not very much. Maybe 75 hours. Because I had just come back from Japan in 58, and I went to group operations as an assistant group operations officer. Well, that was at Selfridge. That was in 58, the latter part of 58. They had two squadrons, an F-102 squadron and an F-86D squadron. Now, the 102 squadron, the operations officer, the only time it flew at night was in the TF-102. Two people in it. So you could say he was afraid to fly the airplane. So, and plus morale was low. The pilots were afraid to fly the airplane. So the group ops officer sent me down to the squadron to straighten the squadron out. So I went down there. I flew on the wing of the new pilots at night, in weather. It didn't matter. I turned around within a week. They were clamoring to fly. Prior to that, they were afraid to fly.
For both of you, considering all the adversity you've gone through in your career, if you had to advise some young person today about what to do in life, what would you advise them?
I advise them going through it. We had problems, but we were able to work around those problems. And I ended up with a full career in the service. And in my case, I thought someone was taking care of me, someone looking down on me. I went into service as a high school graduate, 1 year of college, and ended up with two degrees in the service, a lieutenant colonel, retired, flew in three wars, and came back each time. So you can't beat that. So,
Carl Harvey, what kind of advice would you give to young folks today?
What kind of folks?
Young folks. The young people coming up.
Oh, right out of high school?
Yes.
Okay. They're finished? They're graduated?
They've graduated, and they are kind of, they haven't decided what they're going to do. What kind of advice would you give them?
Okay. Make a decision, but be the best. Strive to be the best no matter what you do. Always aim to be number one. And if you do that, everything will work out. Believe it or not.
Well, I might add to that that especially with the Red Tail group, I talk to a lot of youngsters, young boys and young girls, and I make it a point to talk to the young girls. It doesn't take strength to fly an airplane. It's what you have up here. Everything's control assisted. And flying with, over the years, I've talked with a lot of WASP, Women's Army Service pilots, and over the years, I've run into some particularly fighter pilots, young women fighter pilots, and they're tremendous. It's just that they learn to fly and they think and apply what they've learned, and it became damn good pilots. So you don't have the strength, have it up here.
Doug, kind of walk us through the training program that they went through.
Well, I think the training program in Tuskegee was very much like the training program everywhere in the day. Pilots started in a basic trainer or in a primary trainer like a PT-22 or a PT-26, PT-19 or a PT-17 steerman. Got their initial exposure there, and then they proceeded to a basic trainer like we have here, then on to the advanced trainer like the T-6 that we have here. You know, we were hoping to have our Red Tail Mustang here. It suffered a landing accident last fall, and like everything else, supply chain and labor issues, we were hoping to have it done and not able to have it here, but we just couldn't quite make the finish line. So we'd like to thank a couple groups. Number one is the Riley family. This airplane, you know, these airplanes are tools we use to tell a story, and we've listened to some amazing stories here this afternoon from these gentlemen, but we've got to... The rest of us have a responsibility to keep these stories alive, and these airplanes are an exciting way that we can do that. This airplane has a great story. It served in Sweetwater, Texas as a WASP airplane, and the pilot flew it here this year is Devin Riley, a woman who soloed at Sweetwater, Texas in this airplane. Are you here, Devin?
She's right here.
Right up there. Stand up. Devin Riley. Their family operates the Texas Air Academy in Central Texas, and they train people in warbirds and things like that. So this airplane has a great story. This airplane, an AT-6, it served at Tuskegee, Alabama. The T-6 is the greatest trainer of all time for numerous reasons. This airplane belongs to the National Museum of the Tuskegee Airmen based in Detroit, Michigan. And they have a small museum there and a couple original Tuskegee Airmen Steermans as well, and they're keeping the story there. Brian, are you here? Brian Smith? Brian Smith is the chairman of that museum, and they were gracious enough to let us use their airplanes to fill in today. So back to the training, basically, you know, the first thing about the training in World War II, it happened at airfields, not airports, and an airfield is typically round. And it's typically grass, so crosswind landings weren't a big deal. And, you know, the steerman has a bit of a reputation on pavement. I fly a lot of different airplanes, and nothing makes me pay more attention than a stock steerman on pavement because it's a very challenging airplane to fly on the pavement. But on the grass, it's a big pussycat and a wonderful airplane. And all of those airplanes, especially the Fairchilds, were just incredibly delightful, nice airplanes to fly. And once they got their basic flying skills, they'd move to an airplane like this, the BT-13, affectionately known as the Volte Vibrator. And everybody thinks that's because this airplane shook a lot in flight, but that's absolutely not true. The 985 450 horse Pratt & Whitney is one of the smoothest round engines there is, and this is a delightful flying airplane. But when it stalls, it'll just about shake the windows out of the canopy as it falls through the horizon. And so it got that name. And basically, we moved from this airplane with fixed gear and a 450-horse engine to the AT-6 or the SNJ, depending on what you were flying, or the Harvard, as they call it up in Canada. And the Harvard's got a 600-horse engine. It's got retractable gear, and it has a little bit more interesting stall characteristics. If you look at the wing on the T6, the trailing edge is straight and the leading edge is tapered. So that means the center of lift on this airplane makes it effectively a swept wing airplane. And that means the stall happens first at the tip. And so when this airplane stalls, it falls, brakes hard one way or another. And it's a better exposure to what you're going to experience in the fighters. Instructing in a T6 is an absolute joy because you don't have to talk much. The airplane does the talking for you. If the student makes a mistake and tries to raise the wing as it stalls and falls, it increases the angle of attack on that airplane, and the airplane digs in and goes faster. If you don't have the airplane perfectly aligned with the runway when the tires touch the pavement, it's headed out to the weeds somewhere. And just a fantastic training airplane. And when you are the master of this machine, moving to the Mustang or the P-40 is a very easy transition. And today at the CAF, we use basically the same pathway to get people from wherever they may be. They may enter at this airplane or they may enter at the T-6 based on what their previous flying experience was. But we put them in when they're mastered this machine, then we put them in the back seat of the T-6 where the visibility is more limited. To simulate, number one, the bigger engine on some of the fighters that blocks your visibility. And number two, we want to know that those pilots are ready to bring that airplane back in one piece when there's oil on the windshield. And when you can fly this airplane well from the back seat, you are ready to go fly a fighter. And I've had the privilege of checking out several people in the T6 and moving them on to fighters. And nothing in the world is more fun than that. About 20 years ago now, I guess it was, I had the privilege of checking out Brad Lang in the P-50, in the Red Tail Mustang, and Brad's the son of a Tuskegee Airman, and that was one of the highlights of my life. So on behalf of the CAF and the Red Tail Squadron, we're just really happy to be here and be able to share this with these guys and hear their stories and the positive attitude that they had and their focus to achieve what they did in their lives.
I think one little thing about the T-6, Connie Edwards was here a few years back, and somebody asked Connie, he had a lot of P-51 time. He said, well, what's it like to fly a P-51? He said, it's a good trainer for a T-6.
Amen.
We've got time for just a few questions. Where's my little people that have got the mics? Nobody's here. Oh, okay. Anybody? Question? No one? Don't be shy.
Did any one of you two gentlemen have a personal relationship with Alfred Anderson, Chief?
I didn't.
No, we didn't have a personal relationship with him. He was a chief pilot at Tuskegee, and we were students when we went to that, so we didn't have any personal relationship with him. We got to see him now and then, but not to talk to him.
I've got one question here. That's talked to you a little bit earlier about it. Like Benjamin Old Davis, General Davis, his influence, what he did for you folks.
Well, then Colonel Davis overseas in World War II, they went overseas in P-39s in 1944, but they needed planes in 15th Air Force to support the bombers, so they soon switched to their P-47s in the spring of 44. They flew those for a month, June escort, then they switched to P-51s. But Davis's idea on protecting the bombers was, you're with the bombers, you stay with the bombers. Now, quite often, German airplanes would come in and attack the bombers, and our planes would go after them and maybe drive them away. Well, in many groups, that German pilot may keep going, and our pilots would keep after him and finally shoot him down, but he may be hundreds of miles away. If that happened very often, this bomb group may not have any airplanes left to protect them, and a new German group could get them. So Davis said, you stick with the bombers, no matter what. If you go after a German airplane, he leaves, let him go, you come back to the bombers. And we developed a reputation of having some airplanes with the bombers to the target and back. Now, one thing that they said, Davis said, I'm not sure I didn't hear it myself. He said, you may go after that fellow and shoot him down, and we'll give you a medal for that, but I'm going to court-martial you for leaving the bombers. That's the way he felt about that. So, but his, and we developed a reputation. And from what I understand, some of the bomb groups like to have the red tails with them.
Yeah. Another question? Right here.
Is the depictions that they showed in the movie about the Tuskegee Airmen, is that pretty much all true?
The movie. What did you say about that? It's pretty much along the line, yes. Whatnot. They've hyped a little of it, but no, it's basically true, I think.
Next, right here.
This is for Colonel Harvey. Did you get to fly the F-82?
F-82, did you fly the F-82?
Did you fly the F-82?
F-82?
Yeah, did you fly that?
The Twin Mustang.
No. No, I didn't.
No.
Go ahead.
Is it on?
Okay. It's on.
Yeah, quick question. The gentleman that flew the C-119, did you ever fly into Laos and Cambodia and some of those black ops type submissions?
Laos and Cambodia, no.
Okay.
No, we were Udo in Thailand, and we fly north over the mountains and then go into North Vietnam. Route 7 coming out of North Vietnam, we go down through Laos. We would go up in that area looking for trucks. And then get back.
They used to call that Magia Pass. Right?
What?
Magia Pass is what they used to call it.
The Gia Pass.
Magia.
No, I don't remember that.
Okay. Yeah, I was a B-52 pilot, so I remember bombing a lot of that stuff. So, thanks.
Anyone else?
Bruce?
Brett. Hi, how you doing? All right, is working? All right, cool. I want to know, what would you tell a new pilot that's facing the going into piloted now with no history of aviation and knowing that they're facing a whole different beast in 2020 and 2022, what would you tell them?
What is the question? Someone just going into training?
Somebody's just started in aviation. And
let me tell you about myself. I graduated from high school in June of 42, and I never dreamed of flying. I wanted to be an engineer, that's all. And I graduated in June of 42. I turned 17 that same month. I was too young to get into service. So I got a job until I could get in. And in March of 1943, something happened that I hadn't seen before or after. They said if you're 17 and a high school graduate, you can go directly into the flying program. So I took the test for it and was admitted to it. I never thought about flying until then. In fact, I hadn't even driven a car then, see. So, and I was approved in the program, and then I ended up, when I went into service, I turned 18 in June. I went into service in July and went 6 weeks of basic training. And from there, directly to Tuskegee. It was a direct route into the program. And that's how I got into the program. But I never thought about flying until that offer was made.
So I graduated from college in 1980, and my dream was always to fly, and I would have absolutely gone to the military and tried to fly fighters, except I had glasses, and all the surplus pilots from Vietnam were coming home, so there were no opportunities there. The military wasn't hiring. Retiring military pilots from Vietnam were flooding the airlines, so you couldn't get an airline job, and I went out and got a job. I had a private pilot's license while I was in college, but I never gave up. I had this dream to fly these cool airplanes. And, I'm a farm kid from Iowa, and you could ask, why am I running around the country telling the story of the Tuskegee Airmen? Because that's the pathway I took to be able to fly Mustangs, Corsairs, Hellcats, B-25s. It's using the lessons and that's why this program resonates so well for me. But today, the opportunities in aviation are greater than they've ever been in history. if you want to fly today or if you want to be a mechanic, the opportunities in aviation are off the chart. And all you've got to do is put your mind to it. It's hard work. It's not easy. Just like George said, you know, he met adversity, but he met it head on and never gave up. And this is the greatest time in the world for a kid who wants to fly. Never have we had the opportunities that we have right now.
You mentioned the opportunities. My last flight, the flight was delayed 2 hours because there was no crew. And that's happened a lot to the airlines now. So the opportunities are there for people who are willing to learn to fly.
It's a great career that used to be, you know, to get into aviation, you had to take a terrible haircut on wages for a long time. Today, the regionals are paying, you know, really good wages for co-pilots. Never in history has it been like this.
That's all I've ever done for my life, 60 years of flying. I never broke anything, and I never got caught. That's a big deal. Yeah. Well, folks, thank you very much. It's been great. Colonel?
Thank you, Colonel Hardy. Thank you,
Colonel Harvey. Thank you, Doug, as always.